There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, 1206 FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile on this Friday. Glad to have you here. Lots going on the show today. Hour number two, we'll be joined by Congressman Bradley Byrne. Also, a Mobile historian extraordinaire John Sledge joins us around 1230. And I want to go to some audio here that was recorded just about 7 minutes ago, and that we might be able to sync back up with the president taking questions as well, as President Trump has come out of a meeting with folks, I think the National Order of Law Enforcement, I think that was the group he was meeting with, came out, was taking questions. So I'll run some of that audio here as President Trump was speaking just about 7 or 8 minutes ago.
I think the Democrats don't care about the people of our country. I really don't. I tell my people the Democrats do not care about the people of our country. They don't want to do what you should be doing for the people of our country, whether it's unemployment or anything else. And all they care about is the election. And they're going to lose the election. You see what's going on with the polls right now. I guess we just got one over 50%. Rasmussen just came out. You see what's going on. Because the people get it. The Democrats are playing for November 3rd. And we're playing for the good of the people. It is a disgrace that they're not negotiating. But they're only looking to play a political game. I happen to think it's a bad political game. I think it hurts them.
I know that they look at you and what you say publicly different from what they hear from the nation and Meadows. Are you willing to spell out exactly what you want right now?
They know what I want. And what I want is I want our people to be able to live and live well, because it wasn't their fault that China brought in this pandemic, that China brought in this plague. It's China's fault. You want to know the truth? China should be paying for it. And maybe they will. Maybe they will. You'll watch. You'll watch. What else?
Mr. President, if we can ask you specifically, we heard yesterday your frustrations about how long it'll take to count the ballots here. Then why are you spending more energy to get the resources and the funding for the states that they want to be able to secure this election for all Americans?
Peter, you know nothing about my energy. Okay, you know nothing about what I'm doing. Listen, you know nothing about what I do. So NBC, I just told you about the false report that NBC put out the other night about the mayor of Portland. And this is the kind of stuff you get. You'll see what happens. And it's common sense. Everyone knows mail-in ballots are a disaster. You just have to take a look at the last recent. Take a look at New York City. Look at New York. They're still counting your ballots, Pat. Do you know that? They had a race, a small race by comparison. By comparison, tiny. It's so messed up. They have no idea there are ballots missing. Thousands and thousands of ballots are missing. They think they're going to send hundreds of millions of ballots all over the United States, and it's going to come out. You won't know the election result for weeks, months, maybe years after. Maybe you'll never know the election result, and that's what I'm concerned with. It'll be fixed. It'll be rigged. People ought to get smart. And I just hope our Republican voters, the people that are for you, are going to do what they have to do. Absentee ballots are great, because absentee ballots, you have to go through a process to get them, and it's actually a great thing. Absentee ballots, I'm going to be voting absentee. An absentee ballot is one thing. A universal mail-in ballot is a disaster. These governors are going to send out millions of ballots. They don't even know where they're sending them. I already have friends. They got ballots for a son who died 7 years ago. You don't even want to talk about it. But the media knows this. Actually, the Washington Post wrote a great article of all groups. A week ago, the Washington Post wrote a great article that this is a disaster. This is going to be
the greatest election disaster in history. And by the way, you guys like to talk about Russia and China and other places. They'll be able to forge ballots. They'll forge them. They'll do whatever they have to do. People should go and they should vote or do an absentee ballot.
So what are you doing?
All right. So a little bit of what the president led with here just about maybe 10 minutes ago now, and a discussion of a couple things, but that absentee versus mail-in. I tell you what, we have time. Okay, we have time for the break. I want to jump into this here before we go any further and kind of walk through. Most of you all probably know the difference, but for those that might not be fresh on the difference here between absentee ballots and mail-in ballots. So that gets thrown around, right? So we talked about absentee ballots. We've talked about absentee ballots here in Alabama, right? Just back to the runoff election back earlier this month, mid-July. So a little breakdown here. So absentee ballot versus mail-in ballot. What is the difference? Are there differences between the two? So let's go through this. All right. So first of all, absentee ballot. Okay. So an absentee ballot is something that you use instead of going to the polling place. You can't be, you're absentee. And there's, I'm sure, different states, different rules on why, you know, you're going to be absent, why you're not going to be there, travel or health, or there's a different list of things. But you are still associated with your polling place, right? You just have a absentee ballot that goes in and you fill it out. You request it, right? You go get it or request it. You fill it out, and then you make your votes, and then you send it in. So the absentee ballot is used for an absentee vote, which is usually sent in by mail. I guess you could, I may mess up on this. I guess you could maybe hand deliver those to the polling place, but most people just mail them. So that is the absentee voting. And that, by the way, absentee voting goes back, they said, to the Civil War era in our country. And every state in the union allows some kind of absentee voting. All right. And federal law actually requires ballots to be sent to military and overseas voters for federal elections. Okay, so there's, once again, to get your absentee ballot, registered voter must request one. So you actively ask for the ballot through your, you know, like for Mobile County, probate judge Don Davis's office. That's how you go get your absentee ballot. All right, so everybody's good with that. Then there's they're like 16 different versions of what you can, how you can request a absentee ballot. Okay. Then there's a mail-in ballot. This is what the president was discussing. This is the other. So five states now, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Utah, and Hawaii, already conduct their elections through a mail-in process that is referred to as all-mail voting. That's M-A-I-L. Registered voters in those states automatically receive a mail ballot. So in other words, they don't go request one. It shows up to your address, right? Or the last address they had. Which, by the way, just the way this stuff works, I told y'all I filled out my census, like I hope all of you have in Alabama. It's very, very important. So we're selling a house right now, and we live in a house right now, and I have census. I've filled out the census for where we live now, but I've got a census request for my old home. What should you do? You should tear that up. But all right, so in the situation, all mail voting in these states, all registered voters will receive a ballot in the mail. It goes to their address before Election Day and has to be mailed back by the voter or deposited at a voting location or a drop box by a certain time on Election Day. So this is push, not pull, okay, for those who know what I'm talking. Like in absentee voting, you have to pull, you have to ask for the absentee ballot, you have to go get it, you have to request it, fill it out, and send it in. In mail-in voting, they send you without requesting. If you're a registered voter, you get the ballot. It shows up in mailboxes all over. And you heard the president talk about people that had gotten them that weren't alive. We've heard all the stories over time. So those ballots go out, and then the voter fills them out and sends them in. Okay, so mail-in ballots, they say here, said what general mail-in ballots are called varies by state. Some states call them advance ballots, some call them ballots by mail, some by mail ballot, some mail ballot, some mail-in ballot, and mailed ballot. They're all mail-in ballots. It's just different words for it. So absentee ballots are sent through the mail, or they said very occasionally somebody could fax them, but not all ballots are sent through the mail or absentee ballots. So, once again, there's a difference. The vote by mail situation is the ballots go to all the registered voters and whatever their address is. The absentee has to be requested to get that. And so the president is upset with the not absentee, but the vote by mail situation. So that's what, I mean, you could come down on this on either side and we could talk like we have in past shows, questions about fraud, questions about just, listen, the two interviews we have with Dr. Alec Gastonzak from out the University of South Alabama, there's also some non-nefarious things that happen with mail-in voting, just screw-ups. And things that, you know, not even somebody trying to move the political needle, they just screw it up. That happens as well. But that is the problem the president has with the mail-in voting, has no problem with the absentee voting. So I thought it was worth talking and tackling on today because I'm looking at text here and people are saying, well, thought they were the same thing. They are not the same thing. So once again, absentee ballots, you got to request, you got to pull it, you got to go ask for it and pull it in a mail-in ballot state. They push the ballots to the people by your address for registered voters. All right. Coming right back, more Midday Mobile. And coming up at 12:30, historian extraordinaire John Sledge joins us. So much to talk about with him and Bradley Byrne at 1 o'clock.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 12:20, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Friday. Glad to have you here. We'll be checking in with John Sledge here shortly and Congressman Bradley Byrne joining us a little after 1 o'clock. Also checking in with my buddy Angelo right now at Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry. Wow. Gold and silver, my friend. Wow.
Yeah. Trust me, you don't have to tell me the wow side of this. It's been chaotic. Yeah, for the last 2 weeks, gold and silver have been taking off like a rocket, to the point where gold hit its all-time high and didn't even slow down, didn't even notice it as a spot, just kept on running.
Let's and talk about that as well, that you look at gold and you look at silver and the ratio between the two. I mean, gold is making headlines, for sure, but there's also a chance for folks to get in on silver.
People have been really diving in heavily on silver. If you look at gold and silver prices, when gold was $1,920, which was the last high, silver was almost $50 an ounce, within cents of 50 bucks an ounce. Now gold is over that $1,920 high mark, and silver is around the $24, $25 price point. So it obviously has a long way to go to catch up to where it should be by most examples. And because of that, lots of people have been buying lots of gold and silver, mostly silver here at Mobile Bitcoin.
Yeah, because of that ratio. And you've been teaching us that over time. Also, when we buy precious metals from y'all, gold and silver, we do that tax-free.
That's something a lot of people are learning, is we can sell gold and silver now tax-free here in the state of Alabama. A lot of places you try to order online, you get hit with that online internet sales tax, even though it's not a bullion tax. There's an internet sales tax online. You don't have that when you come into the shop and buy it right here in Mobile.
And speaking of buying, we're always talking about coming in to buy things from y'all, but y'all are buying things from us every day.
We are. So if somebody's got gold or silver they've been sitting on waiting for it to hit that high point, well, guess what? Looks like we're there. So if you want to go ahead and take advantage of that, come by the shop right here at 2204 Government Street. Let us take a look at your items, make you an offer, and maybe you can walk out of here happy with a nice check.
All right. Good stuff. Tell us how to find you.
Yeah, we're in Midtown at 2204 Government Street. Of course, you can always check out the website, mobilebaycoins.com. And if you want to see some of the cool stuff as it's happening in the real world, like us and follow us on Instagram and on Facebook.
Hey, thanks, Angelo.
Have a good weekend, Sean.
You too. Angelo checking in from Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry and Precious Metals. My gosh, those numbers have been wild on that. All right, 1224. More questions about people. Okay, let me try to simplify this. Absentee ballots, you got to ask for. Mail-in ballots are sent to you. Okay, so in all cases, they should be associated with registered voters. But once again, the absentee, which we had, I think, probably the highest number, highest percentage of people voting absentee happened mid-July in the runoff election. because of COVID and people's worries about that. So people took advantage of absentee voting. In other words, saying, hey, I'm not going to be there to vote. And the Secretary of State opened up the, relaxed the rules on what would be considered a health situation that would keep you from voting. I mean, you didn't have to prove that you had some health issue. You could say just worried about your health and you could absentee vote. But you had to request the ballot, get it in, and then send it in. I think it was by like July 9th or something like that, this last go-round. So that's absentee voting. Mail-in voting in these states is where they send, they go down the list, and I think it's five states here. I think it's five. I'll have to look up the list again. But these states send the ballot to you. So you're a registered voter, and your address is, you know, at 1234 Main Street or whatever. They send, yeah, so it's a Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Utah, and Hawaii, five states that conduct their elections through the mail-in process. So they send the ballot to you. Like, it shows up in the mail, here's your thing, you fill it out, turn in, and send it back in. Now, in interviews we've had in the past, not just for ballot harvesting and nefarious things that could happen with those mail-in ballots that are sent to, you know, people's addresses that they may not live at or whatever anymore. There's also, and then you can go back in our podcast, which, by the way, and we're getting ready to be with the debut of Jeff's show, Jeff Porcia, which we'll talk about in a second, the debut of his show on Monday. We'll be at like 58 hours a week of locally sourced from the studio programming, and those will all be available, like the 40 some odd hours are now available in podcast form. And you can go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe, or really Spotify, TuneIn Radio. They've all got our podcast. Pretty much, if there's a podcast provider out there, they've got our podcast. Or you can just go, if you want to get it a la carte, to fmtalk1065.com. And on our website there, you'll see the link at the top, or the thing that says podcast. You click that and go, and you can get them a la carte from there. But what I was going to say is, we've had two different interviews with Dr. Alec Yasensack from the University of South Alabama, who's talked with us about not just the nefarious things that could happen, but also the just the screw-ups. I mean, the stories of, how many stories have you heard over time where they find somebody who was a work for the post office, right? And they find some storage unit or storage units that are just piled full of mail that the person for some reason didn't want to deliver or what, those kind of things. Also, people, if you do something incorrectly on your mail-in ballot, right, if you sign it for some reason, because that identifies you, you can't do that, or you do something that's like a clerical error on that ballot, they can't tell you that you did it wrong and you get to revote. It just doesn't count. So there's, so beyond just, and I know the political discussions all around the, you know, nefarious and ballot harvesting and all those things that could go on, and you ought to watch that in some critical areas where you have either a state that's purple or even a region of a state, like Florida, right? Florida, the northern part of Florida, the panhandle, North Florida, yeah, usually going with the Republicans. South of Orlando goes for the Democrats. You have that I-4 corridor, which is like a battleground there, goes back and forth. Different presidential cycles, goes back and forth for Republicans and Democrats. That would be an area that they would be, you know, if you're looking at fraud, you'd look at somewhere like that. But if you look all around the country, you could just have people messing up, sending in those mail-in ballots. So that's the beef on the president. I don't know how much he was just trolling the other day when he said maybe push the election back. I would say he came on to said, because his first tweet was... he said the mail-in voting would be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. But he did come back later on Twitter and said, I want to have an election, but I also don't want any, don't want to wait for 3 months to find out that all the ballots are missing and the election won't mean anything. That's what's going to happen, and everyone knows it. Now, I don't know that everyone knows it. And he got pretty quick pushback from not only the Democrats, but Republicans as well, saying, nah, the election date's going to be on the 3rd, is everything's going to be as per normal, we'll have the election date. But he is pushing this right now, and he was talking about it in that presser earlier. All right, and a couple, I did mention that coming up on Monday, brand new programming here at FM Talk 106.5, a voice you know, person that's been on the air with me maybe a decade here at FM Talk 106.5 as a guest and a guest host of this show on several occasions, Jeff Poor. He is bringing his Jeff Poor radio show to this station, part of the FM Talk 106.5 family, 5 days a week from 9 to noon. That starts on Monday. Now, Jeff, you read his work in Lanyap, Yellowhammer News, Breitbart News as well. He's got a heck of a Rolodex. I know, kids, Rolodex, it's just a term. He has a bunch of connections, y'all. Yeah, I know you don't know what Rolodexes are, youngsters, but he has a lot of connections in Washington and in Alabama with the newsmakers, the elected officials, people running for office. He will flex that on this station every day of the work week, and that starts Monday. Real excited about Jeff Poor, and that gives us, by the way, 8 hours in a row of live local talk here at FM Talk 106.5 every weekday. From 6 in the morning till the start of Feinbaum, folks sitting right here in this chair that I'm sitting in right now doing shows locally. No one's even close to that along the Gulf Coast in our area, and I'm super proud of the crew we put together here. So that starts Monday at FM Talk 106.5. All right, John Sledge joins us next. Stay right there.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. I find myself in my happy place every time I get to talk to this man, historian, author, a great Mobilian, John Sledge, joining us now to talk some history. Thanks for your time, John.
Thank you, Sean. As
I want to also remind folks, too, the new book for the Gulf of Mexico in stores now, right? And people got a little extra time on their hands. Here's a time to sit down and digest this.
Exactly. Good time.
So talk about the most recent book.
Yeah, it's called The Gulf of Mexico Maritime History. And, you know, the Gulf Coast often gets overlooked in American history. We always talk about the Pilgrims and the settlement of California, and people forget there's a third coast, which has a long and rich tradition and culture that's manifested in customs like Mardi Gras and cuisine like gumbo and architecture like Creole cottages, and all of that got its start via maritime history, ships bringing cultures and peoples into the Gulf. So I wanted to explore all of that and loop the whole Gulf together, not just the United States Gulf states, but also Mexico and Cuba.
You know, you talk about the transition here into what we're going to talk about today. Those ships also brought guns. They brought cannons. They brought soldiers here to the northern Gulf Coast and flew many flags when they did. And you and I were talking during the news break, and I think you made it made a good point saying it's a trap we fall into. But you ask most people about military and for sure any discussion of naval and Mobile. It's the Battle of Mobile Bay. We think about the Civil War. We think about that battle. We think about damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. But that's just one of the naval activities and the battles that went on here right in Mobile Bay from down the bay to up to Mobile.
Very true. And in fact, naval conflict goes back to really the beginning of European settlement here when Narvaez, the Spanish conquistador, in 1518 was coasting along. Remember, he had Cabeza de Vaca with him.
Yes.
They came into Mobile Bay on some makeshift vessels they had made after they came to a bad end in Florida, and they were floating somewhere off Fowl River, and Mobile Indians came down in dugouts, and there was a confrontation. Hostages were exchanged, but then the Indians chased them out of the bay, throwing slings and arrows, and never returned the hostages. So that was really a little naval squabble quite early on. But we had a very full and rich colonial period as well, because you had Britain, France, Spain, as well as the infant United States during the Revolutionary War, all vying for this stretch of coast. And so what I wanted to highlight as well was that particular story and how colorful it was, with the Spanish in New Orleans and then kicking the British out of the Mississippi Valley and then moving on to take Mobile and then Pensacola, which materially contributed to the American victory and the American Revolution.
That's something we don't think about. And the most recent piece in Mobile Bay Magazine, The Siege of Mobile 1780. So we're now talking, you know, here in the revolutionary period. And you in your story write that Mobile was part of British West Florida, an underappreciated, quote, 14th colony, end quote, that stretched between the east bank of the Mississippi River and the Apalachicola River. So,
yeah.
So during the colonial revolution, we were in play here in the northern Gulf Coast?
Yeah, absolutely. We were not in rebellion. The West Florida was very lightly settled. The colonists were mostly just struggling to survive. But then when Spain joined France against Britain, it didn't become an official ally of the United States, but it became a surreptitious friend, because the Spanish realized anything we do to help the American cause will defeat the British, and that's in our interest. So Bernardo de Galvez was the Spanish governor in New Orleans, and he was very decisive as a leader. He quickly moved and expelled the British from Natchez and Manchac. Then he moved on Mobile in 1780 in the really late winter, early spring, and besieged the city for a period of about 2 weeks, dug zigzag trenches up to it, opened fire on it, both from vessels in the bay and as well as siege guns, situated about where Broad Street would be today, firing at where Fort Conde is, or Fort Charlotte, as the British called it. And so the fort was very weak, undermanned, and very quickly the walls became breached and just turned into rubble, and the British commander realized he couldn't defend it, so he had to surrender. Then the Spanish moved on later, the next year, and took Pensacola. What that did was it really compromised British naval power in the Caribbean and the South, and it freed up the French and Spanish ships to help the Americans at Yorktown. So you could argue that the victories of Spain on the Gulf Coast literally helped America win the Revolution.
It is amazing to picture that period of time and just, you know, thinking about how the states are laid out now. But to know that there you had this British-controlled 14th colony here of West Florida, and then just right across, New Orleans on the east bank, and then the area on the west bank of the Mississippi River, that was Spanish country, right? Spain had that, and they were that close. It was like a Spanish-English border here in the New World.
Yeah, just an international border. And, of course, the British, of course, everybody wanted New Orleans because it controlled the Mississippi River Valley, and the fur trade penetrated all the way to Canada. Whoever dominated that valley would dominate the continent. In fact, Jefferson was terrified when France got New Orleans and as a result of a trade. And he just, you know, and then, of course, Napoleon turned around and quickly sold us the Louisiana Purchase, but prior to that, Jefferson was terrified. He just thought a foreign power holding New Orleans will strangle this country. So control of New Orleans was absolutely vital. And then you had the silver mines in Mexico, which Spain desperately wanted to protect. So right there, the Mississippi River and coming on over to the Pearl and even the Perdida, you had all these foreign powers. You had all of this ambition and all this anxiety about how do we protect our interests here. And, of course, the Indians were a tremendous power at that time, and everybody was vying for their influence and help as well.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think the way the nations were laid out then. This area, I guess, on the west side of Mobile Bay, this was Choctaws, right?
Exactly, Choctaw Creek to the east,
and so
Cherokee to the north.
So these European powers were trying to find their allies in different tribes.
Yeah. Playing them off against one another, using them to attack each other's Indian allies as well as each other's settlement. You also had another element in the mix, which were runaway slaves, or Maroons, as they called them at times. People like Seminoles in Florida, who were Creeks who would filter down into Florida, and slaves would sometimes join these groups, runaway slaves. And so powers like the British, when they came in, as well as the Spanish, saw these as potential allies against their enemies. If we could enlist their help, make promises, give them supplies or food, then that will help tip the balance. Because really none of the European powers was strong enough in and of themselves to completely carry the day. They had to have help.
Just joining us, talking to John Sledge and talking about a lot of things, but a lot of this is focused in the most recent Mobile Bay Magazine and the Siege of Mobile 1780 story. And to go back to that for a second, you talk about here the Spanish come. They did they have any opposition at the south end of the bay? Could they come the whole way up to Mobile unopposed, or how did
their big problem was the weather. Just getting into the bay with those sandbars and shoals, they had several ships run aground and they had to work them off and so forth. But yes, they were able to get all the way up to Dog River, which was where they unloaded and set up a large camp, and then began doing reconnaissance up closer to the city and moving up toward it in greater force. The British had a strong garrison in Pensacola, and in fact they sent over a relief column, quite a strong one, but it got caught in bad weather in Bowen County and mired down in bad roads. And by the time they reached the eastern shore, they could see that the Spanish flag was already flying over Mobile, so they were too late.
So the British fort, so Mobile at that point would have extended, because you point out that the Spanish, I guess, I don't know if they put in batteries, but they put in trenches there, basically where Broad Street is, and the English were in Fort Charlotte, which is where Fort Conde is. Was there a city they were in, or was it, you know, was it open ground before the fort? Where would have the people in the fort?
The city was essentially a military outpost, but yes, there was a town out and around the fort itself. There were several dozen houses, and the residents were a mix of blacks and Indians and Europeans, both Spanish and English and French families who lived there. Only a few hundred civilian residents, and about 300 soldiers, as well as slaves that both the British and the Spanish employed. And the Spanish also had 3 black troops. So it was a real racial hodgepodge, like so much of what happened on the colonial Gulf was. And in fact, as the Spanish were approaching, the British commander, a guy named Elias Durnford, to clear fields of fire, he had several of the houses burned around Fort Charlotte, and, you know, basically evicted the people and said, take what you can carry and get out, we're burning your house. And they of course would later file claims against the British government, but Galvez sort of sent a tongue-in-cheek little message to Durnford and say, you know, it's customary for forts to protect their towns, not to burn them down.
And at this point, he is way outnumbered, and as you pointed out, that it didn't take much for the Spanish to take Mobile, and then here come the British, which at that point was Pensacola, because I mean, I'm thinking back to, you know, even later on in the War of 1812 and all that, was Pensacola the more desirable port than Mobile, or which?
They both had their advantages. Pensacola was a better deep water port. Mobile's advantages, even though it was a shallower bay and couldn't support deep draft naval warships, they could anchor off Dauphin Island. Shallower vessels could come into the bay. But Mobile had that wonderful river system, which allowed them to go far into the interior, again, to coordinate those Indian alliances. Also, Mobile, for the Spanish, was a rich source of cattle. They had a lot of cattle, turpentining, logging, naval storms were a big deal. After Mobile fell, they were always shipping masts and naval supplies down to Havana to the Spanish Royal Shipyards. So Mobile had a lot of advantages. Plus, it was like an early warning system. Once Mobile fell, then the Spanish had a chip between New Orleans and Pensacola. So if the British tried to pull a surprise, the Spanish would probably find out about it because of their garrison in Mobile first. So they had a lot of good strategic reasons for taking Mobile first.
All right, we're coming right back. More with John Sledge, historian, author of The Gulf of Mexico, A Maritime History, many other books. His most recent, The Gulf of Mexico, A Maritime History. Coming right back. More History Talk with John on this edition of Midday Mobile.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. Midday Mobile, FM Talk 106.5, and continuing our conversation with historian extraordinaire John Sledge, and always a treat when he's on. And we've been talking about the most recent book, The Gulf of Mexico, A Maritime History, but I'm looking at my text line here, John, too, and people are Still talking about the Mobile River book that I've been recommending for years. And if y'all have yet to read that one, make it like if you go buy two of them at a time, go buy several John Sledge books and sit back and read and get educated here. We're talking about your latest piece, too. People can see in Mobile Bay Magazine here about, and people hear this and they go, what are they talking about? Civil War, the siege of Mobile? No, this is 1780 when that happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the many. One of the military moves that were here in our neighborhood. Heck, I mean, they're not all from warfare, but how many, you pointed out one time, how many shipwrecks are in Mobile Bay?
Almost 300, if not more than that.
300, y'all. 300. You know of about two, most people, and there are 300 in Mobile Bay. And you mentioned, too, when you're talking about the situation here in Mobile and Fort Charlotte, what we call, you know, Fort Condi, and you started laying out, okay, here we have the Spanish, and they're sieging the fort that's controlled by the English, and this is, you know, British West Florida here. Then you flash forward to 1812, the War of 1812. And I'm just reading a book here, just finishing up a book, that has, you know, the scenario laid out. Here comes Andrew Jackson and the Americans to Pensacola, where you said the British reinforcements were coming from before. At that point, the Spanish and the English were both occupying Pensacola. They on the same team.
Yeah. Well, the Spanish had Pensacola at that time, but they were allowed the British Navy access to the bay, and this terrified the Americans. It infuriated Andrew Jackson. And, of course, again, what the Spanish and the British were doing were promoting unrest among the Creek Indians, as well as runaway slaves, Maroons, and trying to urge them to attack American settlers. So the frontier was very unsettled there. And also the Creeks were going down to Pensacola and getting gunpowder and arms. And that's how the Battle of Burnt Corn Creek came, because the Friendly Creeks and some American militia attacked hostile Red Sticks coming out of Pensacola with arms and munitions, and the attack ended up going badly. But of course, all that ultimately led into the Creek War and just the disruption of a foreign power on our border like that.
And I'll get into, and if we don't get it all done, we'll have you back on for in-depth discussion, because you know I love to talk about the Creek Indian War. But here we have. With it, we already talked about the Choctaws and their alliances, and then we talked about the Creeks. But within the Creeks, you mentioned Red Sticks, but there were also White Sticks, right? So you had Creeks that were fighting with the Americans against Creeks fighting the Americans.
Yeah, I mean, the Creek War was really a civil war. I mean, one of the great tragedies of that was that a lot of these people knew each other. You had families divided. You know, there was an assimilationist group within the Creeks who could see the writing on the wall that America was going to be a dominant power, that hunting and subsistence agriculture were no longer sustainable, and they needed to settle down and farm and adopt more of the white man's ways, as they would have termed it. And of course, the Red Stick faction resented that. They resented the Federal Road penetrating through our area all the way to Mobile and bringing in large numbers of whites from Georgia and the eastern seaboard. And so the traditional factions within Creek society felt threatened by all of this. And only that led to just this awful civil war.
And other than this strip right here along the coast, you know, this was frontier country. This was the West. I mean, it's weird to think about, because we, I guess, you know, growing up, always thought the frontier was, you know, north and west or west and north in our country. Yeah. But back then it was south. I mean, people coming from Tennessee south into this uncharted country.
That's very true. I mean, even into the Civil War, they referred to this area as the Southwest. And one of the things that's fascinating about all these stories and all of these events is that it's not inevitable that the United States came to be. It isn't inevitable that it turned out the way it did. You realize how often in the past it was a near wrong thing, and the wheel might have turned a different direction. And what you see on the Gulf in the 18th, early 19th century is nobody could have predicted then what the map would look like now. It just, the last thing anybody would have expected would just this infant, weak nation, the United States, that could hardly govern itself, would end up in control of just this vast territory.
and to the point that I think so much of history is forgotten. I mean, look at the War of 1812. Just watching a shot on one of my monitors here of the White House, you know, in Washington.
Yeah, yeah.
And to think the British came back in with torches and set Washington on fire.
Exactly. I mean,
they came back for more.
We defended on the Canadian border, and we were vulnerable in the Gulf. The Mississippi Valley was in. When the British came to New Orleans in 1815, they came with an incredibly powerful fleet. I mean, their biggest warship would be like an aircraft carrier today on your coast. The HMS Tonnant, it had been captured from the French. She had 80 cannons on board.
Wow.
And hundreds of men. And there were other ships almost as large, and they were all anchored out there off the Chandelure Islands. And they could do whatever they wanted. And here they come with these Napoleonic veterans who had won in Spain under Wellington. And you telling me a bunch of dirty shirt Tennesseans and free blacks and Baratarian pirates and Choctaw Indians are going to turn these guys around. And by God, that's what happened.
You know, it's and to talk about today and talking about diversity in our country and recognizing diversity, I want to point out whether it's a scenario you're laying out for Mobile under siege in 1780 and the people that were there, or, you know, the Battle of New Orleans. You just laid out a picture of, I mean, Native Americans, Europeans, African Americans, so many different people that came together there and fought the British. The British had at least they had a thought that most of these people would turn against the Americans when they showed up,
right? And in some cases the British successfully recruited ex-slaves or freed ex-slaves and promised them freedom if they would fight on their side, but by and large people felt, of course not slaves, but people like the Baratarian pirates felt that their interests lay more strongly with the United States. They felt if the British controlled New Orleans, we're going to have a lot of rules here, you know, and we're going to be beholden to a foreign king, and they could just foresee a lot of difficulties, plus just a lack of free trade on that river, which would have strangled the country.
Yeah, it had been bad for the ledger sheet for the privateers, Lafitte's privateers and others. And, you know, you mentioned this about the unsurety of the success of our country and what the map would look like. And I think, you know, you can flash forward all the years to the war against the Sioux and the Plains Indians and the Battle of Little Bighorn. And Custer's death there was a loss of a battle, a loss of life. But I don't think anybody back in Washington thought at that point, well, we've lost here. It was just a matter of time, right? But back in early 1800s, it wasn't sure that they would win any of these wars.
No. Well, and even in the Little Bighorn, I mean, one of the saddest things I ever read for the Native Americans that resisted so powerfully there was that a lot of the Indians thought that the soldiers they were fighting in Wyoming or Montana or wherever it was, that they, you know, encountered these different commands, and the Indians just thought those were different tribes. They didn't realize they were one united nation. They were soldiers under one flag, fighting, you know, for a common endeavor. They lived within a tribal system themselves, and so when they would encounter these different detachments, that to them was just a different tribe.
Oh,
and
wow.
they really just, unfortunately for them, didn't realize the power of the American war machine that eventually just ground them down.
Manifest destiny. And we'll have to pick this discussion up again real soon. You'll come back on with us.
Oh, at any time, Sean. I greatly appreciate it. I
always love talking to you. John Sledge, author of The Gulf of Mexico, A Maritime History, among many other books that must be in your bookshelf. You live here, you want to know our history, you want to know it in depth, you need to read what John writes. And just, you can Google him or send us a text in here, and we'll give you a link to the books we talked about today and probably several more on that list. All right, coming back, hour number two of Midday Mobile. We'll start off the hour with Congressman Bradley Byrne joining us from Washington. Lots to talk about there with the HEROES Act coming out of the House, and the Senate had the HEALS Act. And what did Speaker Pelosi say earlier in the week? It was like trying to mate a giraffe and a flamingo. I don't know where her mind was, but that was a metaphor she used, and we'll talk about that with the Congressman when we come back.